everybody. Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, administrator, and we got an awesome show lined up for you today for this 4th of July weekend. First up is Jacob Hornberger. He is a former Texas trial attorney from here, believe it or not, and professor at the University of Dallas. He's the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Welcome to the show, Mr. Hornberger.
Hey, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an honor to have you on the show, sir. You wrote this article last week called How Hitler Became a Dictator. And I thought, well, you know, this is kind of old hat sort of stuff to me, somewhat. But I thought, you know, probably in this country, people will have probably a pretty poor understanding of the history of the Nazis and World War II. And everybody knows what a jerk Hitler was. But nobody seems to know how he got to power, and he did a really good job of explaining that. So I thought maybe I'd bring you on the show, we could talk about some history today.
That would be great.
So your article begins with the election of 1932, where Hindenburg got 49.6%. Was he the incumbent?
That's correct.
Okay, and then Hitler got 30.1%. A guy named Thälmann got 13.2%, and a guy named Duesenberg got 6.8%. What's the relevance of that? Why did you start your article with that?
Well, to show exactly how the German people felt against Hitler. You know, although I didn't mention this specifically in this article, a lot of the bombing of civilian targets was being justified and is still being justified, like the firebombing of Dresden, the notion was that the German people were responsible for the evil acts of Adolf Hitler. Well, in the election of 32, I wanted to show that most of the German people opposed Hitler's election. Since he only got 30% of the vote, then obviously it stands to reason that 70% of the German people voted against him. And then, of course, ultimately he rises to power, so I wanted to show how exactly he was able to achieve that.
Well, you know, I think when a lot of us watch old footage of Hitler and we see just what a raving maniac he was, or, you know, maybe that's just the clips they show, but he's always pounding his fist and screaming at the top of his lungs. And people wonder, how would any civilized country, I mean, we're talking about Germany, one of the cradles of Western civilization, how could they ever resort to putting a guy like Hitler in charge?
Well, what appears to us to be raving lunacy doesn't necessarily appear that to people who are responding very strongly to very emotional rhetoric. Keep in mind that in the 30s, before the concentration camps got established, that Hitler was considered a great world leader by many of the people, including in the West. I mean, it's hard to believe that a guy like Winston Churchill would say that if England ever finds herself in the same straits as Germany, we hope we will find our own Adolf Hitler. Hitler was, in fact, copying, or vice versa, many of the economic policies of Franklin Roosevelt to get Germany out of the Depression. Massive government spending, massive armaments building, spending on military warfare and so forth, claiming that this would help them out of the Depression. Economic regulations, cartelization, public schooling, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, many of the things that Roosevelt was advocating. So at that time, he was looked on by many of the Germans as well as the West, unlike the way we would look at him as libertarians or advocates of free market philosophy, as somebody who was pulling Germany out of the Depression.
Well, and I guess the Depression has all sorts of different reasons that caused it, but a lot is made, even in the general public, like History Channel, sort of general reference kind of history, they don't usually like to talk about inflation and its causes. But when they talk about Germany, they say that, you know, basically the government had the printing presses on full speed in order to pay the debts from World War One, and that destroyed the economy enough that, you know, the Great Depression that the rest of the world was suffering just added on top of it. Is that your understanding?
Absolutely, and this is what Hitler was able to capitalize on. So again, what we would look at is this crazy lunatic. What this guy was able to do was to punch the emotional cords of the German people. And for that, we need to understand why the German people respond to that. We go back to World War One and the aftermath of World War One. That ordinarily, if it had not been for U.S. intervention in World War One, the probability is there would have been a negotiated peace in Germany, the way there had always been in these European conflicts. As a result of U.S. intervention, however, the Western powers were able to just break through German lines and actually demolish the German army, so that at the end of World War One, there was just massive chaos. The communists were vying for power. The Nazis were vying for power. You had this democratic republic, but yes, they were printing. The printing presses were going full steam. The German money was just flooding into the market. There was massive inflation, massive destitution, chaos. So along comes the Great Depression that started over here, and with the stock market crash, it actually aggravated the system that was going on in Germany. Hitler knew how to capitalize on that. Then when you add to that what had happened at the Treaty of Versailles, which was just a massive double cross of what Western powers had promised the German people, including Wilson's 14 points, humiliating them, taking away property that they had promised not to take away. That Hitler, when Hitler comes along, despite the fact that a lot of people had called for revising the Treaty of Versailles, saying that this is just a treaty of vengeance, reparations and so forth, they had failed to do that. And Hitler comes along and is able to push all those emotional cords among the German people.
Basically playing the victim and saying, I'll get revenge for you, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. And some of his arguments were exactly the same arguments that people were making prior to that time, saying, look, we need to revise these reparations. It's time to, you know, let Germany come into the economy, restore some sense of balance, prosperity, and so forth. And the Western powers would have nothing to do, nothing with that. So the vengeance was still going on in the 30s. Hitler knew how to capitalize on it.
In your article, you say that after he lost the election, I guess there was a runoff and he lost again, and the president, Hindenburg, appointed a guy named Franz von Papen to be the chancellor. And what was the story with him? Just completely ineffective?
Totally ineffective. Could not get anything done. Could not get a coalition within the German Reichstag. And so you end up having sort of a stalemated government. Couldn't accomplish anything. Von Papen was somewhat of a ludicrous figure in German history at that time. And now, in the meantime, Hitler, of course, is despondent. He hasn't gotten that many votes, but at the same time, he's drawing massive crowds. And his National Socialist Party is drawing a massive interest. And in this deadlock that takes place in the Reichstag, Hitler is continuing to demand that Hindenburg now appoint him chancellor. Put him in total control of the state. And that's what ultimately happens, that there's this deadlock, gridlock in the government. Nobody can form a majority coalition. And finally, Hindenburg, who's very old by this time, sort of throws in the towel and says, okay, maybe by bringing Hitler in, I can co-opt him, bring him close to me, watch him, control him, and so forth. And, of course, the exact opposite happens.
Is it true that it was Hitler's brown shirts that were going around causing all the, or at least a large part of the chaos and crime in the streets of Berlin that Hindenburg was reacting to?
Of course. The Nazis understood that the greater the chaos, the more that people would call for order. And for that, that's what the Nazis were promising, that, you know, put us in power, we will establish law and order in Germany. And so the more chaos, the more people were responding positively to the Nazi message.
What's the evidence for this? I mean, what are your sources that you quote?
Well, the primary book is Shire's book on the history of, William Shire's book on the history of Germany at the time of the rise and fall of the Third Reich. That's the primary source that I use for my article. But, of course, you know, I've read a lot of other things, like the best biography of Hitler, I think, is John Toland's two-volume biography. And then Toland's also got a good book on the history of that period. But for this particular article, this article is really just mostly factual. And for that, I just relied on Shire's book.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me that the way you wrote this, it seems to parallel current events in the United States pretty well, and yet you don't seem to mention that, although it does sort of seem like that's what you're getting at. Am I right?
Well, I don't make any reference to current events at all. I just wanted people to know how it was that Hitler not only rose to power, how he became chancellor, but it was much more important than that. I wanted people to know how Hitler became a dictator. Because remember, Germany had a democratic republic, so in a sense, we're dealing with a democracy here, with an independent legislature, the Reichstag. So finally, Hindenburg appoints Hitler chancellor. And I wanted people to see how it was that Hitler was able to get dictatorial powers. That this wasn't just a man that said, I proclaim myself dictator of Germany. This was a nation that followed the rule of law. So he actually went to the German Reichstag and said, let me have temporary emergency powers. And this is what I wanted Americans to see, is to see exactly how dangerous it is in a time of crisis, and it was a time of crisis, it was Hitler's war on terrorism that enabled him to do this, and that's what I wanted to go into in the article.
His war on terrorism, what terrorism?
Well, what happened was that after he was elected chancellor, there's a fire in the Reichstag, the German congressional building. And now this would be comparable to a terrorist attacking the U.S. Congress. A communist terrorist goes in there and firebombs the Reichstag, just burns the whole thing up. And immediately there are calls for, we need to do something. I mean, imagine if the same sort of thing did happen on 9/11, but this was the German congressional building. So immediately Hitler goes to the German Reichstag, to the Congress, and says, look, we've got a terrorist crisis here. And it's magnified by the fact that we've got a communist threat, because keep in mind that one of the advances of World War I also was the triumph of the communist revolution in the Soviet Union. So not only is Hitler facing a communist threat, or so he says, but he's also facing a communist threat, the same sort of threat that was used to build up our military-industrial complex throughout the Cold War. So he goes to the Reichstag and says, let me have temporary powers. Let me suspend the Bill of Rights, or what they call their Bill of Rights. And this will just be temporary. It'll just last for a few months. Don't worry. As soon as those 6 months are over, we will restore the rights to the people. And there were people in the Reichstag that objected to this. They said, this is not what Germany stands for. And Hitler said, well, look, this is the way we're going to achieve freedom for Germany. And
you quote him in your article saying, Germany will be free, but not through you.
That's right. He's talking about his opponents. His opponents are saying, if we give you this power, then that's essentially dictatorship. And he says, oh, no, you give me the powers in order to get rid of these terrorists, and that's the way we're going to achieve freedom. And so it's going to be through us, the Nazis, rather than through you. And so when the vote's finally taken, Hitler gets the two-thirds majority he needed to suspend the German Constitution. That's what has gone down in history as the Enabling Act. Anybody could Google that, the Enabling Act, and they can see exactly what I'm talking here, that the German legislature voluntarily relinquished to Hitler these temporary powers.
How long was it after that they started calling him the Führer?
Well, when von Hindenburg dies, he is able. Hitler's able to combine the positions of president and prime minister. So I'm not exactly sure when they started calling him Führer, but it had to be after that. But what matters here is that when he had these powers, he was then able to disappear people. In other words, take out his opponents on the basis that he's fighting terrorism. He's establishing order and freedom for the German people. And then once he's able to knock out a certain percentage of his opponents, then obviously that cows the entire nation. And so my point of the article was not necessarily to say, oh, well, this is what's happening in the United States. I want people to see this is the danger of what happens when you permit the executive branch of government to suspend the Bill of Rights, suspend the Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment. For example, in this Padilla case, it was just decided this week, where the executive branch is saying, we need the power to arrest American citizens and punish them without a trial, without due process, without habeas corpus. This is the danger. This is the dangerous road to go down. For Americans to suggest that Americans could never fall down that road, that's the most dangerous thinking of all, because every human being can go down that dangerous road. Power tends to corrupt everyone.
Well, and it's pretty easy to look back in history and see Hitler for the embodiment of evil and sadism that he was, and assume, I would assume, that it was, for him, predetermined all along. He knew exactly what he was doing. This was all a premeditated plot for him to become the dictator. But I wonder, I guess you pretty much just answered the question, that's not really necessary, is it? You could have kind of accidental dictators who just believe that this is the right way to go, who would create the very same structure and the very same corruption.
I think that if you were able to delve into Hitler's mindset and everything that Hitler wrote and spoke, he never considered what he was doing was evil. I mean, in his mind, he was truly fighting to restore order, stability, and freedom to the German people, protecting them from communism. And let's not also forget that it's not just Hitler here we're talking about. I mean, it's easy to demonize Hitler and make this look like this tremendous aberration in history. There were ordinary German citizens that had to have participated in this machinery. I mean, you know, the Gestapo, the SS, all the bureaucracies, the Social Security Administration, the public schools, the Hitler Youth, the concentration camps. You know, this is what I think Americans have never really grappled with. We focus only on the concentration camps and only on the millions of Jews that he killed. Well, I think we need to focus on much more than that. What were his economic policies? Why were they immoral? Why were they harmful? What was his court system? What was his judicial system? Another article, I think my most favorite article I've ever written, that's on our website at fff.org, is The White Rose. And it is a story of some German students who took on the Hitler regime in 1942, distributing pamphlets secretly. And it was a story of their courage and their resistance and the judicial system that Hitler implemented. That's what I wanted to bring to people's attention, too, that you need to have an independent judiciary here to do what, like the Supreme Court did this week, in constraining the powers of John Ashcroft and the Pentagon and President Bush.
Do you think, when you talk about all the economic policies in Germany and the entire structure, is it your opinion that the Holocaust and World War II is just the natural result of the creation of a total state like that?
Absolutely. I mean, when the state is big enough to take care of you, and this is what we've been writing for 15 years at the Future of Freedom Foundation, when you start turning over the state to the state, the power to take care of you from birth to death, you are granting the power of the state to destroy you. And this is what Hitler did. I mean, he had a paternalistic welfare state. When we talk about national socialism, we're talking about the roots of Social Security, national health care, public schooling. All these things originated in Prussia among the socialists of Germany around the time of the late 1800s. These ideas that are alien to what our founding fathers had. And this is what we often argue, that it's not just the concentration camps. It's this mindset that says the government is here to take care of you. Relinquish your money, relinquish your privacy, relinquish everything, and we'll take care of you and we'll never do bad things to you. That's just nonsense. Very, very dangerous thinking.
It's funny because as much as the parallels are happening at the national level within the government, I really have trouble in my own mind really comparing Bush to Hitler. It's much easier for me to put the American people in the place of the German people during that time.
I totally agree. I don't think it's constructive to compare anyone to Hitler. I mean, I get so tired of hearing that. Oh, he's a Hitler. He's a Hitler. He's a Hitler. I don't think that's constructive at all. And I think that sometimes these people in the administration, Bush, et cetera, might have the best intentions in the world. But even then, I would argue that some of the worst acts in history have been done by people who were well-intended. And our founding fathers and the framers place these restrictions on power knowing that well-intended people would try to abuse power. That's why our ancestors insisted on the Bill of Rights that said Congress will pass no law respecting the establishment of religion or abridging freedom of speech. Congress. Now, the reason they did that is because they knew that Congress attracts people that are tempted to do that. And it's the same with the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, due process of law. write to an attorney. Look, you've got the Bush administration and John Ashcroft denying people the right to speak to an attorney. What's that all about? They have all the good intentions in the world. Let's concede that. That's not the point. The point is that this is a dangerous road for any society to be traveling down. And as the Supreme Court said in these decisions this week, national emergencies are the time when you've got to be most vigilant against your own public officials taking away your rights.
Well, I can't imagine somebody on our Supreme Court saying that. Was that a Republican that said that?
It was actually an 8-1 decision, and it was a very, you know, I would invite everyone to read these decisions. They're linked in an article I wrote called A Supreme Reason to Celebrate the 4th of July, and they're also located on findlaw.com. Our website, again, is sff.org. But yes, these are really beautifully written opinions. Scalia and Stevens, for example, write about the dangers of overgrown military establishments and how our ancestors tried to warn us against a standing army and overgrown military establishments. Sandra Day O'Connor writes that the existence of war is not a blank check to do whatever you want to a citizen, and they exalt the citizen. They raise the citizen to a prime importance in society and say government's not going to just indiscriminately do bad things to citizens. And it will not suspend habeas corpus, which is a linchpin of a free society. Without habeas corpus, all the other so-called freedoms become a dead letter. And these are the things this court wrote about. It's very, very moving language. You know, people, Americans really owe it to themselves to read the language in these opinions.
I wonder if you know offhand, I know you do because I saw the links in your article this morning, about the founding fathers or the founders, I hate the founding fathers thing, but the founders of this country, the people who wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, would they have budged on this at all? I mean, is this as absolute as you say it is?
Would they have what? I'm sorry, I didn't understand you.
Would they have budged? I mean, hey, the two giantest buildings fell down and we're at war against Islamo-fascism and what have you. Would they be as steadfast for the Bill of Rights as you are?
Absolutely. But they understood that you could not trust public officials, even themselves, with crises like that. And, of course, war is the biggest crisis where it's the biggest excuse to take away people's freedom because it's the time when people are most willing to give up their freedom. So when they enacted the Constitution, they said, these are going to be the powers of government. This was the original Constitution, very limited powers. And they said, and here are the restrictions on your powers. Only Congress has the power to suspend habeas corpus. They understood the importance of habeas corpus. But then as soon as the Constitution is adopted, the people are saying, oh, no, that's not sufficient. We want express guarantees that you will not interfere with due process of law when you accuse somebody of a crime. Write to counsel, write to an attorney, write to confront witnesses, write to jury trials. Well, what they were saying is that people like Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, who are obviously the ones that are going to be elected to office, could not be trusted, that no one can be trusted with omnipotent power. And that was the strong message they sent. That's the great gift that they've bequeathed us down through the ages. And thank goodness that they have a judicial branch of government to be able to rein in these people, because by golly, I think we know that the Congress, this Congress we have has just been nothing but passive lapdogs that have done everything that the administration has wanted. I mean, it's been absolutely disgraceful.
Well, you know, when I read those Supreme Court opinions, I really wasn't all that impressed. I mean, first of all, they really ducked the question on Jose Padilla, didn't they?
Well, ducked it in the sense that they held that the petitioner had brought the case in the wrong jurisdiction. They brought it in New York, and the jurisdictional rules require that it be brought where the person is being held, which was South Carolina. So in that sense, they did duck the Padilla decision. But make no mistake about it, Padilla is going to get all the benefits of the decision of these two cases, which were Hamdi and then the Guantanamo Bay petitioners, because Hamdi's an American citizen. He gets habeas corpus relief. The Guantanamo Bay people are foreigners. They've already filed papers yesterday, habeas corpus petitions. So Padilla's already filed. As of yesterday, his attorney refiled in South Carolina. So that district judge that considers that, he's effectively going to be bound by the language in the Hamdi and Guantanamo cases. So for all practical purposes, what we're talking about here, see, it's not a question so much of whether these people get freed or not, because that's not our, what our judicial system's about. Our system's about giving people a chance to be heard. And this is what they were denying Padilla, just the chance to be heard. And so now they have to hear Padilla. They have to either, they're either going to have to bring charges against him or show some justification for being held. This is a monumental victory for the American people.
Well,
it's the same, yes.
You know, going back to the total state thing, I mean, I was really nervous that they even heard these cases, as bad as it was, because, you know, it's up to these nine doofuses in black robes who are appointed for life to decide whatever they want. And once they've decided it, that's good enough. And it seems to be your opinion that you think they did the right thing this time. But, you know, here we are with this $2.3 trillion government per year that, you know, the final say is left up to these, you know, Scalia and Thomas.
Well, Thomas was horrible, shameful in these decisions. He was the one in the 8-1 that said we have to defer the executive. But when you look at it, you know, it's easy to become cynical because of the kind of society in which we live and which the government continues to take more and more of our rights away. But when you look at it as how it was designed, and you've got an independent branch of government consisting of judges who have lifetime appointments so that the executive cannot fire them, cannot threaten to withhold their pay. They're not dependent on them, whose job it is to protect the rights and freedoms of the American people from executive assault, congressional assault. The system worked this time. Before these cases, the president and the Pentagon were claiming the power to establish an independent, quote, judicial regime in Cuba. With the same process that mirrors Fidel Castro's system to treat terrorists. No due process, no attorneys, sham kangaroo, military tribunals, all the stuff Castro used. And they were saying, we don't have to answer to the courts, we can do whatever we want, torture and whatever. The Supreme Court has reined them in and said, no, you will answer to us, and we will make the ultimate decision as to whether these detentions are proper or not. And it's the same thing with Hamdi, who's an American citizen. They're saying
this is, you know, the same institution, the Supreme Court, are the ones who all along have said, oh, you know what, the General Welfare Clause does mean that Congress can do whatever it wants. And the Interstate Commerce Clause does mean that the Congress can do whatever it wants. And the Commander-in-Chief Clause means that the President can do just about whatever he wants in a perpetual state of war. As you know, the War Powers Act, since the end of World War II, the President is considered constantly the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. I understand, you know, it's better that they're appointed for life and so they don't have to depend on the President for their job and that kind of thing. But I guess I'm just attacking the idea of even having an Article 1, 2, or 3 at this point.
What I'm suggesting is that if it had not been for these decisions or the power to render these decisions, these would be very, very ominous times in America. I wrote an article called Crossing the Rubicon that showed that this power that the President and the Pentagon are now claiming, the power to arrest any American, newspaper editor, dissident, radio talk show host, writers, whatever, to arrest them, take them into custody, label them an enemy combatant, ship them to Guantanamo, and punish them, including execution, without any due process of law, that's the scariest exercise of power, possibly even since the Civil War, because no one is safe at that point. No one. For example, if they picked you up, you would have no ability to go to the courts and say, stop them from doing this. The Supreme Court put the brakes on that.
Was there a Supreme Court in Germany in the 30s?
Absolutely. I mean, they had a very fine judicial system.
And they told Hitler it was okay to suspend the Constitution, or I guess they weren't allowed to meet after that, huh?
Well, what happened was that when the trial came up for these terrorists who had firebombed the Reichstag, the main guy, I think his name was Van der Lubbe, I think he was Dutch, he goes before a regular court, a regular trial, and he's convicted. But there were people who were accused of participating with him. And they were acquitted. I mean, they were actually acquitted. This was just a regular German court that said, we find them not guilty. This absolutely infuriated Hitler and the Nazis, that a court would dare to stand up against their will. They had accused these people of being terrorists. And so what Hitler did was he established the people's, what he called the people's courts, with special judges that had been appointed by him.
Oh, the people's courts. Nice.
You got it. And in fact, it was one of these people's courts. There was a judge who was just a Hitler lackey named Freisler that tried these people with the white rose. And of you know when the kids went up there for their trial before these people's courts, they accused them of being unpatriotic and not being raised well by their parents, and how could they do this? And Sophie Scholl, who was about 21 years old, she was German. She says, "Look, somebody had to make a start here, and we're the ones that made the start." And of course, they were beheaded by the Nazi regime about 2 days later. But the point is that the reason that Hitler was able to get away with that is that he had a judicial system by virtue of the fact that he just slowly started abolishing the regular judicial system of independent judges, where they just became his lackeys. And so once you lose your independent judiciary, and I agree with you, the Supreme Court's made a lot of wrong decisions over the years, but by golly, without an independent judiciary, then the executive's going to be able to do whatever he wants.
Yeah, well, and you know, if you're Philip Drew, the radio show host, or Jacob Hornberger, the guy from the Future of Freedom Foundation, you know that your name's on that list, too, makes you want to fight even more, doesn't it?
Absolutely, because the margin just keeps changing. You know, they start out with guys like Padilla and Hamdi, but all of a sudden, when they realize that the Supreme Court, for example, suppose the Supreme Court had ruled in their favor and said, we'll not interfere with you. No matter what you do, we will not interfere with you because this is war. I will guarantee you, if that's where the margin starts changing, once the Pentagon knows it's got the same power here that it has in Iraq, I mean, look how they're treating people in Iraq. They have no constitution to answer to, no Supreme Court, and so they've got warrantless searches and seizures. They're barging into people's homes. They're killing demonstrators. Do you honestly believe that they would not do that here if they didn't think that federal judges would slap them down, hold them into contempt, and actually fight them for contempt to put them in jail?
You know, when I wonder, what the hell are we doing over in that part of the world? I can't help but think of World War II. And really, our involvement in that war is always held up as, you know, the good war. And, you know, as soon as September 11th happened, all the TV channels started running World War II movies at top speed in order that we can all, you know, remember the wonderful glory of the good war, World War II, which is funny that we have to go back 50 years to find a good war. But anyway, it was really, you know, since then, we never really had a republic again after that. I mean, we've been all over the world ever since World War II ended. It's like we became the Germans in order to stop them.
Well, it was very ironic because immediately after the war, some of the files are now coming out that U.S. officials aligned themselves with many of the Nazis that they had previously condemned and brought them into the administration in order to fight their previous ally, the Soviet Union, who supposedly had liberated peoples in Czechoslovakia and Poland, but actually ended up occupying their countries in a brutal occupation for some 50 years. I mean, it really goes to show you the perversion of the results, that despite the fact that they claim the results are fantastic, Poland, which is why Germany and France declared war in the first place, was not freed at the end of World War II. Neither was Czechoslovakia, neither was East Germany. These are people that suffered under the same type of brutal regime that Hitler had. People often say, well, how could the world have lived with Hitler? Well, we live with Stalin and his successors, and they were just as bad. But yes, you're right. We rose up with the garrison state, the Cold War state, massive military spending, never ceasing. And it didn't come to an end until finally, you know, 1989 or 90 when the Berlin Wall came crashing down. But then they found a new enemy right quick, and that was Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, well, and the war on drugs, that kept us busy in the meantime before we got our Islamo-fascists to go and fight against.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's a perfect example of another metaphorical war, which is what the war on terror is all about. It's an endless war. because obviously you're never going to get rid of drugs in a society. You're never going to get stop people from taking drugs. But it provides the perfect excuse to just keep going on and on and on, no matter how the what the results are. And you're right when you mentioned that about Iraq. What are we doing in that part of the world? I'll tell you what we're doing. We're killing people, and that all their family and friends are just new potential terrorists to keep the anti-terror machine going. So it's one of these perpetual wars, supposedly to establish peace, which is going to accomplish the exact opposite. But sometimes that doesn't disappoint people who love to see government continue growing.
It's sort of like Osama bin Laden and George Bush are the best things to ever happen to each other.
Well, keep in mind that, you know, Osama bin Laden was a former ally of the United States when they were resisting the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Saddam Hussein is a former ally. That's where he got his weapons of mass destruction during the Reagan-Bush years, from the United States and other Western countries. And we've published some stuff on that, too, on our website. We supported the Shah of Iran. This is what I think Americans need to confront, is the bankruptcy of this foreign policy. As you know, there's a CIA agent that's just written a book anonymously that's, you know, all getting stuff publicity all over the internet. He's a current CIA agent, like 22 years, that says, look, they don't hate us for our freedom and values like these people are saying. They hate us because of this government's foreign policy. That's what we need to be examining here, Phil.
I hear a real kind of cycle going on with that. You know, we fight World War II to protect the world from the Nazis, and then we just set the stage for the Soviet Union, and we have to protect the world from them. And in order to do that, we have to, just like we back them versus the Nazis, we back the Mujahideen, and we back the Shah of Iran and Saddam Hussein and all these people to be our check on their power. And now we have to deal with them, and now we have to make allies with new people and turn them into enemies in order to fight this new enemy. And, you know, I guess it's either we're going to collapse as a civilization or we're going to lose at some point, but we can't just keep going like this, can we?
No, it's just like 1984, the book by Orwell, that the enemies change every year. And you're supposed to forget that this was the previous enemy and this is the new friend and blah, blah, blah. The best two books in this area that have been written, I think, in the last 10 years are Blowback by Chalmers Johnson. I'd highly recommend everybody get this book, Blowback. It shows how, he predicted the terrorist attacks, which we were doing before 9/11 as well, said U.S. foreign policy is going to produce this, and sure enough, it did. And then another great book by Chalmers Johnson called The Sorrows of Empire that just got published this year, showing exactly what you're talking about, that the more the U.S. intervenes in these other countries, killing people, destroying their infrastructure, trying to put in puppet regimes, that you inevitably get the other side mad because they're losing family members, they're losing friends, they don't like being told what to do, they don't like this intervention, and they ultimately come after you. And then when they do, then all of a sudden we hear these screams about, oh my gosh, they just hate us for our freedom and values, give us more money, surrender your rights so that we can do more of the same that caused it. That's what we need to put a stop to. And that's what we're doing, Phil, at the Future of Freedom Foundation. We're saying, look, we're not on the right course in this country, either domestically with the socialism and the interventionism and internationally with the imperialism. We need to start reflecting on our founding principles, why we abandon them and what those consequences should be, and whether it's time to start moving back in that direction.
And by the way, since you mentioned the Future of Freedom Foundation, I got to say that I find it a very valuable resource, and one of my favorite writers of all time, Jim Bovard, writes for you as well. Isn't that right?
He writes for us every month. He's been a fine friend since the early 90s when we first got started, and he's one of the people that I respect most in life because he just pulls no punches, and he speaks the truth, and his principles are never compromised.
And you got to tell us a little bit more about the Future Freedom Foundation. How many different writers do you have? You said you've been around for 15 years, right?
That's correct. We got established in 1989, and we started out with just a little publication called Freedom Daily. Our stock writers are myself. We used to have Richard Ebeling, who is now president of the Foundation for Economic Education. Sheldon Richman, who has authored three of our books, writes for us every week. Jim Bovard writes for us every month. We've got Scott McPherson that writes for us, Wendy McElroy, periodically Ralph Rako. But the internet has changed, has revolutionized our operations, because now we have one of the most extensive websites for free market ideas, and we have a daily free market editorial page. We send it
Wait
out
a minute.
7 days a week.
Wait a minute. I'm a confused left-winger in the audience. Did you say free market? But I just thought I heard you talk about how bad all our wars are. I thought that all our wars are capitalism's fault.
Well, that's the difference from the leftists that we have with the leftists. That they often say that libertarians are economically conservative and socially liberal. But you know, we're consistent is what we are, and that is in the sense that we favor free markets from a moral sense and limited government. We oppose paternalism both domestically and internationally. When you see what they're doing in Iraq, it's the same mindset that they're doing here in terms of taking care of people. They're saying the Iraqi people are too dumb and incompetent to oust their own dictator. We're going to have to do this for them. It's the same thing over here when they say the American people are too dumb and stupid to educate their own children. We have to force them into government institutions to do that. They can't handle their own retirement. We have to do that. They're not charitable. We have to force them to take care of the poor through the welfare state. Oh, they can't handle their own health care. We need Medicare and Medicaid. It's the same paternalistic philosophy, and so we maintain a consistency. We have a fierce devotion to free market ideas and to the freedom philosophy that once guided this country.
Sounds consistent to me, although, you know, someone might say that's really a stretch, saying that, hey, we got to have compulsory school because some people just want to educate their kids. Is that really the same thing as invading and conquering a sovereign nation across the globe?
Well, it's the paternalistic attitude that says we need to take care of you because you're not able to do this on your own. And of course, you have to ask yourself, why aren't people competent to do it on their own when most of them are graduates of public schools? I mean, if you've produced this generation after generation of incompetence, why repeat the cycle? But notice what they do with the Iraqi people. You can't oust your dictator on your own. We have to come and liberate you. You can't establish a government on your own. We must occupy your country for 5 years to show you how this is done. It's this same socialist, paternalist nightmare that continues to guide people all over the world, including especially the people in Washington.
Yeah. Well, I guess there are some fathers that don't beat their kids, but, you know, whatever government does paternally, it's always backed up at the point of the gun, isn't it?
Absolutely, and that's what public schooling is. It's backed up at the point of a gun. If you don't send your kids to school, they will put you in jail. What we say, Phil, is it's time to just reevaluate where we are. You know, the free market produces the best of everything. It produces the best computers, the best religions, the best automobiles, the best everything. Why not a free market in education? Why not a free market internationally? We believe in the entrepreneur and the businessman. We believe that capital is what raises standards of living. So what we want to do is the exact opposite of what they're doing in Washington. We want to rein in the Pentagon. We want to rein in this government, bring the troops home, and liberate the American people to travel and trade and enter into business deals, including with people in Cuba. I mean, just free up the American people. Americans are the greatest diplomats in the world, and people in the world love Americans, but they don't like these government officials. They don't like these troops. So we want to do the exact opposite of what they do. They're trying to isolate American people from foreigners with immigration controls and troops on the borders. We want to do the exact opposite. We want to bring those troops home. We want to liberate the American people.
Are these ideas going to break through? I mean, it's the 4th of July, and I like to feel pretty optimistic around this time of year, but part of me thinks that, you know, next week nobody's going to give a shit anymore. And, you know, it's like I saw Newt Gingrich and all them on one of the news shows last week, and they kept calling it a global Islamic insurgency. And nobody stopped to ask, well, insurgency against what? You know, the American empire. It was just a, kind of an unsaid premise that, well, obviously we're not going to stop giving F-16s to Israel, and obviously we're not going to stop propping up the dictatorships in Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So, since we're obviously not going to do those things, we have to fight this insurgency. And it seems to me like, you know, maybe these ideas of liberty that you're talking about are just too over the heads of the American people for them to you know, snap out of it and really go from the Gingrich point of view to yours?
I don't think so. I think that the great boomerang of this Iraqi adventure where thousands of innocent people had been killed on both sides, people who had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11, that this is going to cause the American people to do a lot of reflecting as things start to settle down and so forth, a lot of reflecting on what used to be an esoteric topic, foreign policy. I think Americans are thinking about things they've never thought about. You see it on the internet. They're talking about the Constitution. They're going back and talking about the Federalist Papers. They're talking about what this country is all about, what the Declaration of Independence really says, what is the meaning of rights. I often said that if you can just get people to start thinking and debating and reflecting on these things, we've won, because they're going to figure out that we're the ones that have the ideas and the philosophy, and they're entirely consistent with the founding principles of this country. With the, of course, the tragic exception of slavery, I would be remiss without mentioning that. But otherwise, you look at 1890 America, and you're talking about Americans that established a society when they were celebrating on the 4th of July that had no Social Security, no income tax, no welfare, no public schooling, no gun control, no foreign wars, no Federal Reserve System. That's a pretty stout society when it comes to freedom, and I think Americans are starting to reflect on that.
Yeah, you know, Harry Brown often says that the whole idea was you come over here from wherever you're at and you can have whatever's yours. They're not going to tax you. They're not going to regulate you. They're not going to, you know, lift up your mattress and take all your gold coins. You're free here. And it seems like we still use that word, and yet, boy, we've come a long way since, like you say, the 1890s.
Well, we've abandoned those principles, and so now we think we're free because the government's taking care of us and controlling us. In fact, I often say the plight of the American people is summed up in the words of Johann Goethe, that none are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free. And, you know, if you can just show people that this ain't freedom, well, then now we're on the right wavelength, because now we can start debating whether socialism's a good thing or not a good thing. But when people are convinced that government socialism and paternalism and interventionism and imperialism is freedom, oh, we got a real tough road to hoe.
Yeah, it seems so. Well, what would you say to the argument of just, you know, someone who's more or less apolitical, who hears you talking and says, well, look, the reason we abandoned those ideas is because they didn't work. It's been 120 years of democracy since the 1890s, and we've decided we like it this way. We voted for it to be this way on purpose. We like government schools. We like public hospitals and social security for our old people. What do you say to that?
I would say that why then is Washington constantly coming up with reform plans and new departments and new agencies to fix all the problems with all of these socialist programs? Not only that, I would say that the free market produces the best of everything. Why are you willing to accept something which is secondary in quality, especially when it comes to your children?
Well, but, you know, the free market has the same problem that democracy does, and that is that the most successful product isn't necessarily the best one. I mean, the toothpaste that sells the most is the one with the prettiest girl on the commercial, not the one that's really good for cleaning your teeth. And, you know, think of music. Flip through your radio dial if you're not listening to Radio Chaos. It's terrible. And it's terrible because most people like what's terrible. So isn't that really the same problem that democracy has, that the majority is wrong?
Well, that would be the argument, but the fact that people have, you know, hundreds, perhaps even thousands of choices on computers, and some of those computers are not as good as others, is no argument as to why we should have a government-controlled computer industry like we have the post office. I mean, if the government had taken over the computer industry, it would be run like the post office. And so you can compare the difference. The free market has raised standards of living in this country, the lot of which mankind throughout history could not even imagine. It is just, even people who take vows of poverty in this country live very nice lives. And I think that's what we need to be focused on. Not that from a utilitarian sense, free markets work. They produce the goods, but also the moral sense. That it's moral that people be free to accumulate their own money, that they decide what to do with it, whether to help the poor or not to help the poor, and so forth. That this is what creates a society of compassionate caring, that when you turn it over to the IRS and a welfare agency, that means nothing in terms of caring and compassion. And that's where both people from the left and the right got it all wrong.
Well, we can look at lessons of history, like what happened in Germany in the 30s and 40s, and, you know, or any other empire in the existence of humanity and in human history for that matter. And hopefully we can, like you've done in this recent article, kind of, you know, make those comparisons, look at history and try not to repeat it, right?
Right, and nothing's inevitable. Ideas move people. Ideas have consequences. There's a reason why dictatorships try to shut people like you down and people like me down, because they know that ideas matter, and that's what we're doing. We're just spreading ideas among people, putting ideas in the marketplace, ideas on freedom. And I have the ultimate confidence that we're going to prevail. If they could bring down the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Empire just with ideas, I have absolutely no doubt that we can restore the principles of liberty on which this country was founded just through what you and I are doing.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a real honor to have you on. Everybody. Oh, go ahead.
No, the honor is mine. The pleasure. This has been fantastic. Thank you very much for having me.
Everybody, Jacob Hornberger. He's the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Type FFF.org. And also, by the way, his article about the Guantanamo, real reason to celebrate the 4th of July is in the highlight section on antiwar.com today, too. So check that out. And thanks again for coming on the show, sir. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Phil. Keep up the great work. It's an honor to be on your program.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.